I had known about Tiptree for many years, pretty much thanks to Nicole, but it was Conjunction's publication of her selected letters that pushed me to finally sit down and read many of her stories. I read I'll Be Waiting for You When the Swimming Pool is Empty, about the well-meaning liberal who accidentally, through an excess of goodwill, becomes a despotic deity on a primitive world. I read Out of Everywhere, about the scared little alien life force who divides itself among the consciousnesses of several random humans while hiding from an intergalactic eater. And strangely similar, from the interlinked collection The Starry Rift, I read the novella about the tomboy teenager whose brain gets infected by a lethal but kind and friendly androgynous spore. Tiptree loves a sympathetic, non-dimensional space-dwelling entity. I am the perfect sucker for this, because to me, the most enjoyable sci-fi is that which really tries to imagine the unimaginable. You know, what if my brain is actually an alien? Or what if aliens aren't made out of atoms? Or what if atoms are actually aliens? What about an alien that's totally made out of brains? Tiptree is not a pure thought experimentalist. You know, she has a passionate interest in social allegory, and she engages in plenty of space opera. But she is also deeply, deeply weird. I had thought that reading her fiction after reading her letters might be an odd way of doing things, or at least a prejudicial one. The way that I sometimes feel reading the work of an author that I know well, that I have no impartial entry into the narrative, that I'm reading the author as much as I'm reading the text. In our 59th issue, Conjunctions published the first ever selection of letters by William Gaddis, an author and master stylist whose work I already knew very well. And I remember feeling uncomfortable and awkward and a bit embarrassed to see the author so awkwardly exposed, relatively speaking, his sentences uncontrolled, his thoughts undefended. As revelatory and hugely important as those letters were, for a Gaddis sycophant like myself, it was a little like walking in on someone in a dressing room. But this was not the case at all with Tiptree, because as it turns out, the voice of her letters and the voice of the fiction are very much the same. You know, wildly enthusiastic, yet bitterly disillusioned, ecstatically hyperbolic and obsessively tragic, deeply engaged with violence, power, gender roles, politics, historic esoterica, and love. The letter I picked for tonight exemplifies every one of those themes in a very short space, like one of the thought engrams that allows her psychic bodiless protagonist to deliver complex memories to each other with a single telepathic nudge. Tiptree, in this letter, she espouses her views of feminism, she divulges some personal history about her work as an intelligence operative, she veers into an anecdote about early Christianity, undergoes a spasm of intense self-doubt, gives everything to a passionate passage in which she supports and appreciates Russ, and then ends in narrative, a tiny flash fiction, a moment of pure undiluted loveliness. The letter is like quintessential Tiptree, a Tiptree metonymy. I'm going to skip the opening paragraph. If you are following along in your handout, you will be challenged. Just know that Tiptree is writing by hand to Russ in bed by candlelight during a power failure. For those of you who are not familiar with the work of John le Carré, her reference to Smiley is a reference to George Smiley, a fictional Cold War spy who is particularly associated with themes of double agents and moles. Finally, Tiptree is responding to a previous letter from Joanna Russ, and it's just important to remind you of what Nicole said, that Russ's explicitly feminist themes in novels like The Female Man and her aggressive stance as an SF reviewer and critic occasionally landed her in gender-themed controversies with various camps. May 5th, 1981. Dearest, my much-experienced darling, what you tell about female hatred and absolutism is so true. Oh, God. I hate to say it, especially in the light of Belfast today, but we have some things to learn from men in the way of handling minor hostilities. And the boxers who go after each other viciously and then are found inquiring about each other's health and sending flowers or caring for the loser's children. The U.S. Congress, where a blistering floor fight is so often followed by neutral luncheons. We women have no experience with fighting the issue nor its exponent. Result, men easily join forces to squash us. Not that they're perfect at it, just a lot better. During World War II, the bicycle dump trucks in the Pentagon had signs on them. We are fighting the enemy, not each other. And it took me some months to learn that when my boss in intelligence said the enemy, he meant A, the British, and B, the Navy. In those days, air intelligence was regarded as a dumping ground for unassignables. On some posts, the intelligence officer was also the special service officer who was responsible for storing the horseshoe set, the badminton net, and the beanbags. One past commandant fired his IO because the man could speak and read German. Luckily, this attitude changed soon and never prevailed overseas, where Smiley and his kin taught us lessons A through Y. Z or Z they failed on, as witness the UK moles now surfacing. Does all this free association crap interest you at all? No. What interests you is the dreadful view of sisterhood you are now getting. The hatred, the poisonous Leninism of the purges, complicated by personal envy. When that terrible fund of hatred turns from its proper target to focus on another woman, it's sick, and, never forget it, safe. What would happen if you remarked, "Pretty safe attacking me, isn't it? Always shoot down your allies first. It's such a help against your real enemies." Or if they say you can't be an ally of theirs, wish them luck and depart to conduct your own lonely wars. Easy for me to say, but this crowd with their attractive doctrines evidently was quite a source of hope to you. Damn it, I wish I were there to lend a hand. Do you recall the lovely tale of the old Frankish king who, after being much moved by a Christian missionary's tale of the mob death of Jesus, exclaimed fiercely, "Ah, that only I had been there with my Franks!" The dear old king would have ruined the martyrdom and set Christian history back 1,000 years. Well, we don't need you as a martyr, thank fortune. You are out there, all exposed, in person. You must be damn magnetic flesh, too. Well, at this distance, and conscious as I am of my own physical decay and repulsiveness, I think you're safe with me. My only virtue is, you can say anything to me without ever changing my love, which is solidly based on what you have done and the ongoing beauty of your mind. A totally risk-free lover. Who can only love you more as I curse your peccadilloes. Dull. What? Well, this horrible position, I'm sore from sticking out my stomach to hold the notebook up, is clearly no place to even begin my promised saga of my attempts to genitalize my loves. And when I got thinking of it the other day, this huge bag of history started dumping itself out. So I will just leave you with the last picture I was left with. A bathroom at 4 a.m. In the tub stretched out a red-haired girl of appalling beauty under the grime of a week's debauch. I had just rescued her from the clutches of an assorted bag of faggots in an all-night eatery who were visibly trying to make their weak brains figure out how to take financial advantage of Maggie, this wanderer from a very wealthy, very upper-class Gold Coast family. The home had 9-foot cast-iron gates mounted by a permanent husky. She had called me to come get her. So at 3 a.m., sucker me drives the old open-top Packard through the gray garish streets of the downtown red-light district and was putting her back together, she addled with sex and some, to me then, unknown substance which stank up the car like turpentine, me addled with love. And as she lay there, lovely beyond words, letting me wash her all over, the only thing I could think of to do was to lay peacock feathers over her. Oh, God. I can still see it. May I leave you with that? Love, and a loving good night, Old Scrawley.